Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you like it, please share it. Leave us a review where you found it. It really helps us out. You can also find recipes and videos and information on just about everything else you hear today on our website, splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get to this week's show. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. This week, I'm so excited to bring you a show filled with some real heroes of mine. We're going to talk with Jessica Harris, who knows more about African and African-American and Afro-Caribbean food than just about anybody, and who's someone I count on for smacking me upside the head when I need it. And we'll talk with Chef Mads Refland and forager Tama Matsuoka Wong, a team will teach us to cook our trash before it goes in the garbage. But first, we're going to get in the kitchen with Dale Taldy. Now, I love Dale, and I knew I liked this dude when he told me the story of how he got into cooking Asian food. Because he started as a young cook in a French restaurant. He was just working the line when one day one of the chefs wanted to come up with a riff on an Asian dumpling, right? And Dale's family's Filipino, so the guy turned to Dale and asked him to show him how to make dumplings. In his head, Dale's like, I don't know how to make dumplings, man. I work in the same restaurant as you. But if you're going to turn to the first Asian dude you see and assume he knows all the secrets to Asian cooking, I'm going to make that work for me. So he went home. He watched a bunch of videos on YouTube and came back the next day to school everyone on his ancient Chinese secrets. So Dale's a hustler. And he's worked his way up from that moment to being the chef owner of a bunch of restaurants, including Taldy, where he cooks things that reflect both his Filipino background and the fact that he grew up in junk food and takeout-loving America. So we caught up with him for our series, The Key Three, to ask Dale about the three things he thinks everyone should know how to cook. So Dale, thank you for having us in your kitchen.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for having me, bro.
Okay, so if there are three things you can tell everyone in the world you need to know how to make these three things, what are they?
My three things are how to cook a perfect steak, how to fry fried chicken, and how to make fried rice.
Yes.
My three essentials.
Steak, fried chicken, and fried rice.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the steak. Why the steak?
I feel like, for me, I'm a newlywed. I feel like, yeah, as, and besides being a chef, and, you know, obviously kind of this is my job and understanding how to cook, I feel like a husband, at the bare minimum, should be able to cook a steak for his wife, and it be special, and it tastes restaurant quality at home.
So what are your guidelines? What are your tips?
So I think, you know, with steak, it's one of the most simple things, right? There's not, you don't do much to it. You have to buy a great steak. You have to invest in a great steak. So if you're at the supermarket and you're, you know, and you're rummaging around like the $5.99, $6.99, $7.99 part of a butcher shop, you're lost already. That's wrong. Your wife is worth double digits per pound for a steak. Then, you know, for me, you have to be in the $19, $20 range because that's what good beef costs these days. If you're getting into the single digits with beef, it's not great beef.
And what cuts do you like?
And I'm a firm believer in this. You, especially for a novice or someone who doesn't cook all the time, find a cut, fall in love with it, and make that yours. So if you love ribeye, cook a ribeye every time. If you love a porterhouse, or your wife loves a porterhouse, cook a porterhouse every time. If she's a filet mignon person, cook filet mignon every time. But stick to it and master it. You know, I'm a ribeye guy. A Cote de Boeuf, and so is my wife, luckily. But if my wife was a strip steak person, we'd be eating strip steaks at my house. I mean, I understand that a happy wife is a happy life.
So, okay, So number two, fried chicken. Well, I mean, I'm also a ribeye guy, but I'm really a fried chicken guy. So I feel you on that, but I want to hear your rationale. What is your philosophy of why we all need to know how to fried chicken?
Because it solves so many problems. It helps you in life. I mean, if you and your mother-in-law or you and your father-in-law or, you know, even some of your own relatives are kind of getting into it, just start to fry some chicken. It will resolve some problems. It really will. At the least, it will resolve the problem enough through dinner that you can all enjoy dinner together quietly, not fight, and then continue the argument after we've all dug into a big mound of fried chicken.
Oh, yeah. But it's also one of these foods where it transcends cultures, and so it has so many different variations. Do you have a thing? Do you have, like, that's the way I fry chicken, or that's the way fried chicken should be fried?
So I have a few restaurants, and in these restaurants, we do them a few different ways. We do a rice flour batter for our Korean style, and it's double fried. But we also do a good old southern fried chicken. You know, there's a lot of techniques, and there's a lot of, like, these, my grandmother did it this way, my grandfather did it this way, and I embrace all those. I do believe in a cast iron pan if you don't have a fryer, and I do believe in 310 degrees is the magic number if you are doing a dredge of, like, just AP flour and other seasonings. 310 degrees is that magic number. It is like, you know, it's like John 3:16. It's like fried chicken 310. 310, 25 minutes. Seriously, it's like Bible. That is some Bible stuff going on with fried chicken.
All right. And the third is fried rice, and you're going to do some of that with us right now.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So let's go to the wok.
Sure.
All right, so when you start the magical process of fried rice, and this is like, I want to say, like, fried rice is the food of my people, it's the food of your people, but it's the food of all people, because literally no one doesn't love fried rice.
And every culture where rice exists, there's a version of this, right? The idea behind making fried rice, reusing old rice.
Right. So it's reusing old rice, but often, you know, it's also using whatever else you have in the fridge. If you have some bits of pork left over from dinner, leftover chicken, some eggs, some seasonings, vegetables of any kind.
I feel like the best fried rice are the two things that I mentioned previous. If you have any leftover steak, which is rarely at my house, but even the leftover drippings, fat ends of the steak, any fried chicken you might have left over, pull yes. that. And then just all of a sudden it becomes like, oh, it's a simple steak fried rice. No, it's supreme now yes. because you've added two types of protein and you got eggs and now you're balling out because...
fried rice supreme.
Yeah, it's fried rice supreme, man.
Welcome to Dale's house.
The deluxe combo edition.
All right, so when you start, how do you like to set yourself up? Because I think it's usually such a quick process that you want to have things laid out in front of you, right? So how do you like to set it up?
So fried rice is all about preparing yourself in advance. So all you're doing is kind of throwing everything in a pan or a wok, stirring it together, seasoning it, and it's out. But the advanced part is where you got to chop the onions, the celery, the garlic, whatever bits of protein you're trying to burn up in the fridge, aromatics you might have laying around. You have to have your soy sauce out if you're using soy sauce, chilies. All that stuff has to be laid out. And that's really the hard part of fried rice, preparing everything. So once the wok or the cast iron pan is turned on, you're not doing anything but just adding to the wok and then continuing to stir fry.
All right, so let's do this.
So growing up, I always had eggs in my fried rice. It was the number one thing. And then when I started professionally cooking in restaurants, almost all of the fried rices that we started with had egg in it. And if you don't add egg first, rice will stick to the pan immediately. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. When I was at Budokan, all the guys there were Cantonese, and they said, start with the egg, but keep it young. And they always said that, keep it young. And I had no idea. I'm like
don't we need, overcook it.
Yeah, but I was like, so young chicken eggs? I didn't understand. I was like, what are you guys talking about? But they were just like, just don't overcook it. I was like, okay. But that's a very key part of the fried rice.
Cool.
And getting the wok hot. So this process starts with oil and not being shy about it.
So you got the pan really nice and hot.
Ripping hot. And I probably have 4 tablespoons of oil in here.
Yeah. You stir it around the pan to coat.
Yeah, every part of this wok.
I love that sound.
Yeah. And that smell, that carbon of the wok that you're smelling, that almost breath of the waffle that they say. That's important.
Yeah. So that's the egg, and it bubbles instantly.
Instantly. And now the process starts. So we do shallots, celery. We do pickled jalapenos here. And this is our crab fried rice. Okay. And then I give it a flip. Mm-hmm. So basically we have an omelet there.
Yeah.
So now what's happening right now is the aromatics are cooking.
Right. The shallots and the celery.
And the celery. And then we let this cook, and now we're just giving it a stir.
Yeah. Salt, some white pepper.
White pepper. I can see that it might need a little bit more oil. I'm going to clean off my wok spoon. And then in goes the day old rice. All
right.
The whole point of this wok is to not get char.
Right.
You're not looking for color on anything. It's just to cook it.
Yeah, I think that's a misconception of the wok. People talk about, like, oh, the wok is great because it's hot and it sears. It's not really about searing. It's just about cooking really fast.
Yes.
So you're not trying to get the kind of browning and stuff.
No, like. No, not at all. So now we're adding blue crab.
So the crab is already cooked in this case. So you're just adding to the rice and tossing 100%. It together to warm it all up.
Yeah, it's steam cooked, picked blue crab.
Oh, it smells so good. You're starting to smell that shallot. You're starting to smell a little bit of that celery.
I mean, if we timed that, I mean, it might have been 3 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think one of the important parts of what we did in this wok, and if you don't have a wok at home, a large cast iron is keeping it on the heat.
Yeah.
So for the wok, the motion was keeping the bottom of this wok on the lip of the ring of the burner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a back and forth motion like this. And what we're doing with the wok spoon is pushing the product up and then bringing it back.
Yeah, so it starts to flip on its own.
Correct.
You're tossing it through the air.
Correct.
And you're letting all the sides of the rice kind of hit the wok a little mm-hmm. bit. But in a cast iron, I think most people, if they don't have a real wok, like with all the BTUs at home, you get a cast iron pan super, super hot.
Uh-huh.
And then you were saying before, you don't move the pan in that case. You're just stirring things around.
Correct.
In the pan.
You have to have a utensil that has the surface area to kind of move everything around. I would use like almost like a pancake spatula.
Yeah.
And I think it's less important in a cast iron pan, because you're going to get that ripping hot. And it's harder to control the heat on that because it's going to stay hot. When it's a cast iron, just oil, eggs, and then everyone in the pool.
Dump everything else in.
Yeah, because it's going to be so hot, especially if you minced. And what you saw here, you saw that the celery, the onions, they were all minced very fine, right?
Yeah.
A fine brunoise. You can't have big, large pieces because that takes too long to cook.
Yeah. So you get your pan nice and hot. You get a nice amount of oil in there. You add your eggs, you give them a quick stir, but really you just kind of let them fry up together almost like an omelet.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really touching it too much. You throw your shallots on top, you throw your celery, whatever aromatics you want to use, and you give the whole thing a flip. So now those things are cooking in the oil. And then you add your rice, and it just looked like you would just stir, 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 stir until everything gets hot. And the whole thing took like 3 minutes tops.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very quick cook. So this crab fried rice, we finish it with a jalapeno aioli, fish sauce, mayonnaise, a little rice wine vinegar, and then just pureed jalapenos. So it's almost this pale green. And then we finish it off with black and red tobiko and a little cilantro, and that's really the dish.
That's beautiful.
For me, like, when I came to New York, you know, like, there's tons of great Spanish restaurants here, so every time I had, like, that arroz negro, the paella, or the fideos, they always finished it off with a garlic aioli, and I was like, man, it's such a good move, man. You can eat around it, especially in this dish. We don't, like, mix it in.
Right.
So you can just have regular fried rice, but then you get a pop of this creaminess and this spice and then a little umami from the fish sauce, and it, like, boom, elevates the entire thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had this dish in the restaurant, and I love it. But yeah, to be honest, at home, it's like just a big bowl of plain ginger egg fried rice with some scallions on top, and I'm good. Well, thanks so much for having us, man.
Dude, thank you for being here and letting me cook you some fried rice.
Let's go eat this.
No doubt.
Dale Taldy is chef owner of Taldy and the author of the cookbook Asian American. You can find that recipe for fried rice at splendidtable.com. Coming up, food historian Jessica Harris. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. About 15 years ago, I was in culinary school, and I was learning everything I could about ballotines and galatines and other classical French techniques when one of my teachers one day subtly pointed out that you know, for all we were learning, what do we know about African cooking and how it shaped American food? Almost nothing, really, was the answer, and he told us about a woman named Jessica Harris, who'd written all the books on the subject. Then, 4 years later, I found myself sitting next to her at a dinner, and I was starstruck sitting there because it was a table full of the lions of the food writing world, and I was just a rookie who'd like somehow managed to sneak a couple stories into Gourmet magazine. And I was too shy to start a conversation with Jessica, so I was talking to the gentleman on my other side, and he said something to me like, "So, you're the new hotshot, right? What do you write about?" And I had no idea how to answer him. I mean, everyone at the table had their specialty, they had expertise, and I was just kind of like, I like writing about food. So I totally bungled my way through the question, and eventually dessert came, and then the whiskey, and finally Jessica turned to me. And she said, I'll never forget this, she goes, "Before, when you were asked that question about what you do, you didn't have an answer. You need to have an answer." And I was shocked because how did she even know I was talking about that? And that's when she said, "That's the other thing. You need to always be listening." That is probably the best piece of advice I've ever gotten. And it rang in my head the whole time I was reading Jessica's new book. It's a memoir, not of food exactly, but of her youth in the 70s in New York, when she found herself in the company of the most important writers and artists of the generation, Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, James Baldwin, Nina Simone, and she was the baby of the group. She was getting a lot more advice than giving it, and she cooked with these people and ate with them, and of course, listened to them. Jessica, thank you so much for coming in today.
Hi, Francis. Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
So, early on in your career, like I think very early on in your 20s, you were a literary critic, you were a theater critic, you wrote for Essence magazine, and you hung out with Maya Angelou and James Baldwin, literally the finest minds of a generation. But your best known work is writing about food, and in particular, food of the African diaspora. So when did it become clear to you that writing about food could be as interesting or as fulfilling as writing about art?
Well, I'm not really sure about that. I think it was a gradual thing. I think it was a gradual process. I've always been interested in theater. Mm-hmm. I've always been a reader. But even before I was interested in theater and before I was a reader, I ate. So I think I've always been interested in food. And Essence was the place at which it all started to come together. At one point, I was the travel editor, and we were trying to figure out ways to vary things. So we said, okay, alternate months, let's do travel and food. And that was back in the 1970s, so it was actually probably fairly revolutionary back then, but I became the gourmet. Let's not keep that one, you know, too in the public. But as the gourmet on alternate months, I would travel, and where I went, I would write about particularly the food culture of that place. And because it was Essence, a lot of the places that I went were within the African diaspora, the African Atlantic world. And so that was the genesis, because I was working on a doctorate. My doctorate's on the French-speaking theater of Senegal. So I had spent time in Senegal. I had been to Western Africa. And then this started taking me down to the Caribbean, and this started taking me into South America. And so I began to sort of taste things and make connections. And, you know, my taste buds started talking to me. And what happened was they talked me into the first book, which was Hot Stuff, a cookbook in praise of the piquant. And then they really talked me into the book that I wanted to write, which is the book that started the whole journey, which was Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons, Africa's Gifts to New World Cooking.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just my taste buds are saying this, but my taste buds are saying this, and they're also connecting the dots with that that I tasted last month and maybe that that I tasted 3 months ago. And so it began to form a certain kind of continuum. Yeah. And that was the thing, if you will, about Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons, was I started linking things up in my mouth as much as in my mind.
Yeah. Well, this is so interesting because I also feel like it sounds so ahead of its time. You know, when we talk about quote-unquote American food culture and we talk about, you know, how did we come to the foodie culture that we're in today, people look at the 60s and the 70s and they look at obviously Julia Child as being instrumental in opening America's mind to French cuisine, to looking at the larger world. And we talk about James Beard, you know, opening American eyes to American regional cuisine. But what were your readers thinking when they were reading about cuisines of Brazil, cuisines of the Caribbean, and linking them to culture? Was that something that the readers were expecting?
I honestly don't know. But I mean, I think the readers didn't write anything saying, what's up? What? Why are you doing this? This is crazy. But remember, it was that time in terms of the world of food, but it was also time of a heightened African-American consciousness of Africa. I literally interviewed Alex Haley when Roots came out, and Roots was transformational. I don't think it is possible to overestimate the importance that Roots had for the African-American community at that time. It was like, oh, my goodness, we have a place we're connected to. And It is the South as well as what came before the South. And so that was something that really was a tectonic shift. Things changed in the way that people thought about things. And I think while it was perhaps, you know, visionary or being in the avant-garde in terms of the food world, it absolutely springs out of a particular moment in African-American culture where we were open to it.
Yeah. And in this book, My Soul Looks Back, you write about meals you shared with the most known, renowned, esteemed people in the African-American intelligentsia. And a lot of that food that you describe is very international, is very global looking. You write a story where Maya Angelou prepares lunch for you, and you describe it as a performance.
Well, actually, that was dinner, and it was very much a performance. It was chopping and maybe an anecdote. It was certainly a running monologue, maybe a little snippet of a song, maybe a little dance step and a hip just to close the oven door. It was really the most extraordinary thing, but that was 40 years ago. I mean, we were both very, very much younger. And as that progressed to my very last meal, which was a very simple meal at our house in Winston-Salem, it was a very different kind of, not necessarily performance, but she had exacting taste buds. She knew exactly what she wanted. She had a whole mise en place, if you will, that was called for. She organized and adjusted, and everything was tasted, was sampled, was mixed together. She loved food. She reveled in it. She enjoyed it. She loved eating. She, almost more than eating, she loved entertaining.
Yeah.
And set an extraordinary table and always had the most amazing people around it, but could do it for wacko reasons, too. I mean, I remember once going up to her house in Harlem for a Super Bowl party. Now, that's not something anybody would connect with Dr. Angelou, a Super Bowl party. You know, your head may explode. Yeah. But there it is. You know, there it is. And that's part of the joy that produced the work that created the icon.
Yeah. Tell me about, you mentioned a gentleman who introduced you to her, Sam Floyd, and he was your partner or boyfriend. And you describe the sort of world that you walked into as being centered around his living room, which had a name.
We used to joke and call it Club 81 because he lived on Horatio Street in the West Village at 81. And you never know who you'd find. You could walk into the living room one day and, you know, there would be sitting Maya Angelou. You could walk in another day and it might be Jimmy Baldwin or James Baldwin. Or you'd walk into the room another day and it might be Stokely Carmichael. It might be Rip Torn and Geraldine Page. It's just staggering to think about that world and how those people had a certain kind of connective tissue. All of those folks knew each other. And not only knew each other, but interacted with each other. in ways that were pretty extraordinary.
Yeah.
I was 15 to 20 years younger than they were. I like to, you know, not claim that I was all up in it like that, as they say. I was very privileged. I was literally the kid. I was 15 years younger than Sam, 20 years younger than Dr. Angelou. And in that world, I was there, I can't say by their sufferance because they were much kinder to me than that, but I was there with a sense of, oh my, you know, sort of, it was like lions and tigers and bears, oh my.
You had a sense of the gravity of being there.
I mean, by the time I was in the room with them, we all knew who they were.
Right.
So I was very conscious of that.
So Jessica, as someone who's been writing about food, who do you look at today and think, you know, I really like what they're doing?
Wow. That's a hard one because I think that you're framing it in such a way that I'm going to talk about a younger generation as opposed to my contemporaries. I mean, I don't need to tell you Nancy Harmon Jenkins or Paula Wolford or any of those folks because they're people that most folks know. I would say that I love, and I've just discovered, but I am, you know, I am a reluctant foodie. I don't really, and this is a big confession, I don't really read that much food stuff.
Sure.
That being said, I love Kim Severson and what she does. I love her integrity. I love the way she does it. I love the way she latches on to things.
Yeah.
I have only recently become familiar with Tejal Rao, and what she does, I think, is extraordinary. I like that other voice, that sort of edgy voice.
Yeah, Tejal has such a generous eye in her stories for the New York Times, and you can really sense her lyricism in her writing.
Good spirit. And the third, or the next person, and probably the last person, is Nicole Taylor. And I think that some of the work that Nicole does is groundbreaking, is fascinating and interesting in a way of bringing people together and of really holding the line on African-American food and food ways and understanding something about that. And that brings one last person up who would be Michael Twitty. Yeah. And I think some of the things that Michael Twitty does are just extraordinary.
Yeah.
And there's a whole long list of other people I could add, but I'll leave it there.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you. Thank you, Francis.
Jessica Harris is author of My Soul Looks Back. You can find her recipe for Temboy curry, which is similar to what Maya Angelou first made for her, at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at this week's video about Paul Quinn College. It's a story of a historically black college that shut down their football program to turn the field into a farm, to teach entrepreneurship, and to fight the idea that the only way for black men to succeed is by being athletes. And now, they sell their produce to the Dallas Cowboys. You can see that at splendidtable.org. Hey, do you want a recipe for making no friends whatsoever? It's super easy. All you have to do is put a bag of popcorn in a microwave in your office or dorm or anywhere other humans breathe, pop it for like 6 seconds too long, and wait for people to stream out of there, cursing you for the smell of incinerated artificial butter flavoring. Well, apparently enough people have learned this lesson, because sales of microwavable popcorn have been dropping for years. So our friends in America's Test Kitchen did a totally geeky taste test of bagged popcorns, and our managing producer, Sally Swift, checked in with Jack Bishop to see what's good.
Hey, Jack Bishop, nice to have you back.
Nice to talk to you, Sally.
So is it my imagination, or is microwave popcorn going to be a thing of the past, taken over by those giant bags of popcorn that are in the chip aisles?
Yeah, the trend is really moving towards already popped bags of popcorn. Sales are up 60% since 2012, while sales of kernels that you pop at home or microwave popcorn are flat. People love the convenience of the already bagged popcorn. It's also healthier. It's just popcorn, oil, and salt.
So I want to back up and start from the very beginning. How does popcorn actually pop?
So there's water inside those little kernels, And when you heat up the kernels, the water turns to steam. And that does two things. It starts to gelatinize the starches, same process that happens when you cook rice. And eventually, though, it creates enough pressure that that starch bursts through the tough outer coating of the kernel and immediately solidifies on contact with the air. So that's the puffy white part of any popcorn kernel that's been popped.
Now, you guys did a tasting of baked popcorn, which is why we're talking today. But I want to make an observation. I was surprised when I read the piece that you guys wrote that popcorn kernels all pop differently in different shapes, and that really changes the way they taste. Can you talk me through that?
Yeah, I love this. So we found an expert at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, who said that when a kernel pops, it goes in one of three ways, and this depends on the breed, the amount of water, the amount of heat, and they classify them as unilateral, bilateral, or multilateral. And it totally affects the way you perceive the crunch factor in the popcorn. So let me explain this to you. I'm going to use some animal analogies. So a unilateral means that the starches have gelatinized and popped in one direction. These are the pieces that look like an octopus. They kind of have a round head and then these appendages that all hang down in one direction. The next is bilateral. So think of a butterfly. The starches went out in opposite directions and looks like it has little wings on it with a sort of round center to it. And then the multilateral, think of a little turtle with all the legs coming out of the shell. And so the starches gelatinized and popped in three or four different directions. And so there are lots of little appendages from the central part of the kernel that has popped. And it turns out that the multilaterals are very spongy and soft as opposed to the unilaterals, which are really crunchy. So in order to sort of tie this back to our tasting results, we went through each bag of popcorn, took 100 pieces out at random, and then classified each of those 100 pieces as either unilateral, bilateral, and multilateral. And we found a direct correlation. The more unilateral pieces, those octopuses, the crunchier the popcorn and the better it did in our taste test.
I would love to have seen you guys sorting that popcorn into piles, I have to say.
We're a little crazy. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we're doing in the test kitchen. But the range was some brands only had 4% of the crunchy unilateral pieces, and they were at the bottom of the rankings. Our top-rated brand had 50% unilateral pieces, so it was perceived by our tasters as being much fresher, crisper, and crunchier. So this is really about texture. You know, they all taste the same. There are only three ingredients in all these brands, popcorn, oil, and salt. And while the salt levels can affect the taster's rankings, they're kind of like the middle-of-the-road salt level, it really was about texture.
So what were you top for?
So the top-rated one was Cape Cod, was the clear winner. Our runner-up was Smart Food, then Kettle, and finally Popcorn Indiana. Now, at the very bottom of the rankings, Skinny Pop. This is the one that only had 4% of the crisp unilateral pieces. So interesting tasting. Would never have thought that popcorn was so complicated.
I was surprised to see Boom Chicka Pop at the bottom of your rankings as well. So that is everywhere.
Yeah. You know, this is what we do. We had 21 tasters. Again, that one had not enough of the crisp unilateral pieces, so ended up sort of at the bottom of the rankings. It's the way it goes.
That's the way it goes. Unilateral rules. Who knew?
Who knew?
Thanks, Jack.
Thanks, Sally.
Jack Bishop is Chief Creative Officer at America's Test Kitchen. You can find the results of their bag popcorn tasting at splendidtable.org. And hey, if you would rather make popcorn, you know, the fun way with a stove and a pot, check out this wild recipe for bitter buttered popcorn by Mark Bitterman. It's smoky and super complex with spices and a few shakes of bitters, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, I get to talk with you, so give us a call, 1-800-537-5252. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, now I get to talk with you. Give us a ring, 1-800-537-5252. So we have Zach calling in. Hey, Zach, how you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Where are you calling from?
Northern Vermont, near the Canadian border, Newport.
Oh, right on. Right on, right on. Yeah. Cool. And what would you like to talk about today?
So I've been getting into making my own pasta dough more recently, and it's kind of hard to go back after that. And of late, I finally have been getting ravioli to the point where it's not, like, blowing up in the water. But I've got some ingredients I put up from my own garden, and I'm looking for some advice on maybe I could put some of these together for some ravioli.
Oh, cool.
So what I have is my own roasted red peppers, mm-hmm. you know, flash frozen and vacuum sealed. I have butternut squash that's already, you know, been cooked, and spinach. And mm-hmm. I also have access to, you know, a variety of fresh cheeses as well.
Oh, you're styling, man. So you're, okay, so let me run this over. You have roasted red peppers. You have butternut squash already cooked, pureed or whole or like
pureed.
Chunks. Cool. You have spinach, and you're trying to put them all together in a ravioli.
Or two, or maybe incorporate something into, like, a part of the sauce. I'm all ears for whatever you got.
Yeah. Well, if it's just a simple dinner thing, honestly, I'm a huge fan of just eating lots of vegetables with my pasta.
Okay.
Whether ravioli or not. I mean, if you want to roll them out into pappardelle or other shapes. You know, I very simple preparations I love are, you know, you start some butter and some garlic or butter and onions or butter and shallots. Throw in your vegetables, since in this case they're already cooked. You're just kind of rewarming them. And okay. like that's a very simple weeknight dinner for me. Another combination I love is butter olive oil with garlic and like a pile of anchovies until the anchovies kind of melt. And then you throw in whatever vegetables you have and toss that with your pasta. So those are really easy things that I cook a lot at home. I, you know, get home from work and you can throw it together pretty quick. But if you're going to do a little project into a ravioli, hearing what you have makes you think, man, like, it would be so fun. I've never done this, so
okay.
you might be going on, like, some, like, wild goose chase here, but if you want to go with me.
All right, I'm ready.
Great. So what I would think about doing is you have your pureed squash.
Okay.
Maybe I would cut some of your cheese into that, something mild and creamy, like a ricotta or something, to help lighten it up but also give it some nice body and some good rich flavor.
Okay.
And I would think about taking your roasted red peppers, throwing them, like, in a blender.
All right.
And pureeing them.
Okay.
So that'll be pretty loose probably. So if your squash is a little bit tighter and your pepper's a little bit loose,
okay.
what I would think about doing is putting in like about half the amount you would typically use for butternut squash ravioli. And then maybe use your thumb and kind of put a little divot in it and spoon
okay.
in some of that roasted red pepper puree. And actually before you put in the roasted red pepper, I would taste both of them for sure. For salt, you know, add enough salt so it's delicious. And maybe with the red pepper, add a little dash of vinegar too. Not to make it sour, but just to make it a little brighter.
Okay.
And you can maybe make the squash a little bit richer with the cheese.
Right. That's great.
Yeah, you see what I'm getting at? So what you end up with is if you have a squash in the base and then you spoon in a little bit of the pepper puree on top and then you close that up. I don't know if it'll work this way, but what I'm hoping for you and imagining is they'll boil, they'll come up, and then when you cut them on the plate, you'll have two different colors.
Oh, nice.
Right? You have the red on top of the squash, or if you pop them together, you'll have a nice combination of, you know, that sweet, kind of creamy squash with the cheese and a little bit of the bright, you know, flavor from the red peppers. And that sounds like a really delicious combination to me.
That's great. I like the idea of keeping them separate like that, too, for presentation as well.
If they mix together, then you'll have, like, a nice, you know, tequila sunrise color. Like, that's probably
fantastic.
Pretty nice too.
All right, that sounds great.
Yeah, check it out. Try it.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks so much for calling, Zach. Have fun.
All right. You too. Take care.
I hope that works. I'd feel so bad if he's like, yeah, they all fell apart and they melted. Thanks a lot, buddy. So here we have an email. It's from someone who calls herself Jenny from the Block. It is about sauces. It says, when I read a recipe for something like a curry and it says simmer until the sauce breaks, what does that mean? All right, so this is actually very simple, and I apologize for all of us recipe writers and recipe editors out there who say stupid things like simmer until the sauce breaks, because it's like a cool guy food thing to say, when in reality, all you really have to say is cook it until you start to see oil or fat floating on the surface. And the idea of the sauce breaking is that in a lot of these cases, what you're talking about is an emulsion. So the fat is mixed into the sauce and sort of combined with the liquid until it's nice and thick. But, you know, when you start cooking and heating these things, those bonds break and the fat will start to float to the surface and rebond with other fats. And so when you start to see pools of oil or fat come to the surface, that means the sauce is broken. And in a lot of like French sauces and European sauces, that's considered a fault and you don't want that. But in a lot of cultures, that's actually what you want. So it creates a layer of richness at the top and it creates just a different kind of effect in how you eat it. It's not quite as thick. You kind of get the richness up top and then the rest of it is a little bit more liquidy and a little bit sort of smoother. So yeah, that's all it means. When the sauce breaks, it just means when you start seeing oil or fat rise to the surface. All right, so thank you, Jenny, for that email. And of course, you can email us too. That's contact@splendidtable.org. Or go old school, pick up the phone, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Twitter or Facebook. When I was a kid, after dinner, my mom would always look into my bowl because I wasn't allowed to have anything left in there. She had a saying, every grain of rice you leave will be another pockmark on your future wife's face, which... You know, sounds a little more poetic in Chinese, but no less sexist. Anyway, I learned to clean my plate at the table. But it wasn't until like 30 years later when I started looking at my trash can in the kitchen. And there was all kinds of food in there. The greens from a bunch of beets, the dark parts of leeks, which for some reason every recipe tells you to throw out, but are totally delicious. You know, all kinds of stuff. Something like 40% of all the food grown in America ends up being thrown out. It rots in landfills, it spews out greenhouse gases, and it all turns into one huge stinking problem. Well, Mads Refland, a chef, and Tama Matsuoka Wong, a home cook and forager, are trying to help change that with their new book, Scraps, Wilts, and Weeds. It's a cookbook on making delicious things out of the stuff you usually toss, and our contributor Melissa Clark talked with Mads and Tama about how they cook this way.
Mads, Tama, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So tell me, what is trash cooking?
So I think trash cooking is cooking from things that we would normally throw away. So for example, peels of vegetables, stems of the broccoli, coffee grounds, weeds.
So all these roots, all these stems, all these scales from fish, fish eyes, fish heads, or whatever you could find of throwing away, we tested it. And actually, we did a lot of testing and we threw a lot away to actually came up to the final result. So it was like a process.
And in fact, it's not something that we've just invented. Now, this is how people always cooked and ate. We just stopped cooking that way because we get everything in little packages now. I think it's also a cultural decision that some of it is already made for you by the time you go to the grocery store, but it's also a personal decision that you just decide something is bad or something's good. It's just, you don't have to think that way, but it's a decision that's made at some level.
In the book, you write about part of having the knowledge to be able to do this is to see a lot of the foods in the fields before you bring them into the restaurant or into your own home kitchen. How is that helpful for people?
I think it's important to see the whole part because let's just say you get a fish fillet and you can never see how fresh it is. You can smell it, of course, but you can never look into the eyes of it and say, okay, this is really fresh. Or a whole vegetable, you know, if you don't have the leaves around the cauliflower, if it's just coming in a plastic, you know, you cannot see if it's fresh or you cannot feel it.
One of the foods that you say is has the most wasted parts is lettuce, for example. So tell us about how we can use the whole thing or what we should be looking for.
I do have a funny story about lettuce, romaine lettuce, which is one of the most commonly used lettuces. And so Maz was very obsessed with getting the whole lettuce, and he forced me to take him out to this farm, and he told the farmer to dig out the entire lettuce with the roots. It turns out the roots of the lettuce are very tiny, tiny things like your pinky. So to get a dish full of lettuce roots would require a huge amount of effort. And so then Mads was really focused on the bottom parts of the lettuce that people usually, they cut off the tops and they use that for their salad and they throw away the bottom part. And he got really, really into how delicious and amazing they were. And he put them on the menu at the restaurant he was at the time. And then the problem is they had all these leftover lettuce tops that people had to use, and they had too many of them, and they were just stacking up all over the kitchen. So then he came up with the wilted romaine lettuce tops that you can use if you have too much wilted tops because if you made all the bottoms.
That's funny. So what was formerly known as salad.
Yes.
What about, tell me about fish scales also, because that's something to Americans, we just do not think of eating those at all.
You just have to make it crispy. It tastes like chips. So as long as you pop them in oil, it's like popcorn in a way. Just make it with a lot of salt and maybe vinegar or something, like powdered vinegar. It tastes like sour and onion chips in a way.
That's really
and every American likes chips, you know. So let's make it into something like that.
And in fact, there is a tradition in Japan, the izakaya for the bars, they serve crispy fried fish bones and scales and things as bar food.
I think if you fry anything, it becomes very delicious. Now, also, what about people love to juice? They use their juicers all the time. We throw out those juicing leftovers. What can we do with those?
Oh, there's so many things we can do with that. What we do in the book, we are using it for pancakes. So we dry it and then blend it, and you can use it in pancakes. So you could use it also, like Dan Barber is doing a vegan like burger. So mm-hmm. he's taking all the scraps and mix it up with eggs, I think, and roast it. But we do falafel with it. We do different pastas with it. And another thing, you can also just keep the pulp, dry it, and you can just keep it in storage. And when you need it, if you want to do a vegetable stock, like a broth, you just take it and mix it into water, hot water, and it would be like a dice of bouillon.
Wow. What about coffee grounds? This is another big problem for people, too many coffee grounds.
Coffee grounds, it's very good you're asking about it in a way, because when I used to work at this place, this restaurant, we used it for panna cotta, we used it for sauces. But I thought it was very important because all the waiters was doing this coffee, and every time they did this cappuccino, they throw all the coffee grains away. So I said, okay, instead of throwing it out, just take this bucket here and you just throw it in there and I'll use it for something. So we started using it for panna cotta during infusion into milk and cream, perfect dessert. And then also we started using it for salads, like what do you call it, dressings, infused into vinegars, all these things.
There's a whole section that we have on sort of drinks and dregs, where you think that, you know, you put a tea bag or something and you just use it once and throw it away, but actually it still has a lot of flavor you can use. I think we have a used chamomile flavor in a cocktail.
You can just use it, put it into alcohol, just leave it there. And then the same with the coffee grounds, just put it into alcohol, vinegars, whatever you want, and it will take the flavor from the coffee.
I have learned a lot today from you two. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Mads Refland and Tama Matsuoka Wong are authors of Scraps, Wilts, and Weeds, Turning Wasted Food into Plenty. Melissa Clark's latest book is Dinner, Changing the Game. Mads and Tama left us with a bunch of recipes. You can find seared romaine lettuce bottoms, coffee ground panna cotta, and coffee ground biscotti on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Lynn will be back next week talking to Robert Egger about an amazing organization, LA Kitchen, that has another take on food waste. They use perfectly good local food, you know, the stuff that goes unwanted because of a little blemish, and they use it to feed hungry seniors. In the meantime, let me leave you again with that thought from Jessica Harris that's kept me going for years. She said, "You have to always be listening." Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. Get over to splendidtable.org for all of your food and eating needs. You can register for our free weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, where you'll find recipes streamlined for Mondays to Fridays. And hey, subscribe to our podcast. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Jennifer Lubke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM. American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.